I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Pelizzolo back here with Sam Monson with an action-packed show. We have all sorts of stuff happening here today, including a rugby player. We've got rugby.
No, not anymore.
Oh, okay.
Former
rugby player.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say his name.
Now actual football player.
I'm going to say his name for the first time later
in
the interview. Rugby player turned NFL, potential NFL kicker, spring league kicker, aspiring NFL kicker, Mr. Leader. We'll be here a little bit later on.
Leader.
But Sam, there's a lot to talk about. First, Matt Nagy saying Andy Dalton is the starter for the Chicago Bears. Why everybody completely overreacted to this in typical Twitter nonsense. I'll break that down in a few minutes.
Okay.
We've got Coffee Emporium. We've bought local because we had one of our great listeners.
Somebody sent me a box of 400 stoppers. Because my complaint about why I go to Starbucks instead of Coffee Emporium on the way in is that the Emporium doesn't have the stoppers. So I can't transport
Cheers.
Coffee
Local.
The last critical several hundred yards to the building without it spilling all over me, the car, and everything else. So somebody sent me a box of 400 of these things.
So we have 400 Coffee Emporium coffees that we're going to buy here.
398 now.
Well, 400 total. These are the first two.
So I don't know who it was, right? Because I opened the box on our way out of the last show and I tossed the package in the trash on the way out. I forgot to look at who sent it, like the sender on it. So somebody, whoever it is, one of our great listeners sent me a box of 400 coffee stoppers. I appreciate it massively. We have used the first two today.
Send us an email with your name.
But I don't know who you are.
Yeah, NFLpodcast@pff.com. We want to give you a shout out. We want you to be co-listener of the week
co-listener
of the show.
With this guy who sent us an actual mail.
We
like hard
have
copy.
Not read this yet.
Hard copy.
Yes.
Yeah, so I had Ethan in the booth over there check it to make sure it wasn't something that would get us canceled. But beyond that, I haven't
read it. We also wanted
it.
Ethan to open it just in case it was something poisonous or, you know.
Well, that too. It could have been
Ethan opened
ricin or something. Yeah. If it is, it hasn't killed us yet.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it won't.
I did smell something burning a little while ago.
That could have been it. Shall I read this?
Yeah.
Sam and Steve. The other day, while listening to the podcast, I discovered that there is such a thing as Steve Pelizzolo baseball cards. I didn't know they just gave them out like that. Anyway, I found this quite funny and decided to buy one and send it to you.
Oh my gosh.
It went well with the whole minor league Steve themed fundraiser you've got going on right now. Maybe you've already got hundreds of these. God knows other people don't. But regardless, here's another one.
It cost him way more in postage than it did for the
Thanks for all the laughs and great analysis. Best wishes, Damian B. So
Thanks,
that
Damian.
Means that in here is a Steve Pelizzolo baseball card. Look at that?
Which one's that?
That is the 2008 Connecticut Defenders.
Oh, good old 2008.
With the stash. So this is where, hang on, where am I? This is my camera. This is what I'm going to have to be dressed like, essentially.
He used a plastic for it, too. We got a. It's not.
Hang on.
Yeah, this is
go.
This is poorly planned.
Yeah.
We don't have a camera operator.
Our camera was more capable than that.
No. We'll fix it in post, Sam.
Yeah. I thought our camera was capable of better zooming than that.
Yeah, my 2008 Connecticut Defenders card.
Yeah.
What a team.
Can we, hang on, where's my, there.
There it is.
That's what it looks like. That's what I got to be dressed like.
So Damian sent it as a gift. Let's prop that up on the Western and Southern here. That'll be part of our decorating. The people have suggested that we decorate a little bit more, so there we go. More Steve Pelizzolo cards.
People have suggested that, and two for one podcasts, Austin Gale and Mike Renner, have apparently been soliciting gifts to prop up crap
they
all
have
over
been.
The table.
We will also solicit gifts. We didn't solicit these, but these were given unprompted.
Well, that's the thing. These are unsolicited gifts
that
we are taking advantage of. We haven't yet solicited any gifts.
If you have anything good to maybe help decorate our table to go along with the Western and Southern helmet, we're all for it. But two for one, they need to start. They need to clean up their set is the issue. They've got all sorts of candles and uppers and all sorts of crazy stuff around here. They need to clean up their set. So Austin and Renner, clean up your set. Okay, they're going through a big rebrand over there. They're not going to be two for one very shortly.
Well, that should be part of their rebrand, just
cleaning up their set. Yeah, they should definitely clean up. So that's awesome. Thank you, Damian, for the Steve Palazzolo card. I imagine you found it somewhere between 10 and 15 cents tops. Well, spent about $3 to send it to us.
The postage to get it to him and then to get it to us is
way more expensive.
Way more than the card is worth.
Yeah. The card
like an order of magnitude more.
Now that I'm a football legend, the card value should be taken off, I would say.
You think?
Yeah.
Like 10 to 15 cents?
2008 was the closest I ever was to the big league, Sam. I was
on my
way.
You can tell with the stash. I mean,
I was on my way. Yeah. It was this week, 2008, up to AAA for the first
anniversary.
Time. Well, I was in AA, Connecticut, had my baseball card and the whole thing, and I got called up to AAA this week, 2008.
How low a level can you be and still get a baseball card?
Oh, you could get one in rookie ball. I got a rookie ball one.
Yeah?
With the Brewers. That was stashless.
Stash.
I've got two stash, one without.
Which was the one where you had those ridiculous like chains that were supposed to achieve something that everybody wore back in the
day? Fighting
necklaces. Yeah, those things.
That wasn't a baseball card. I actually may have had a Nashua Pride baseball card too. But that was just the team headshot.
You were like loaded up with those things.
Yeah,
three of them on.
I was wearing Fightin', and then I went up to the Fightin' headquarters in Seattle in 2007. I took a little trip, buddy Mike. Shout out to Mike. We took a little trip, went out to the West Coast, caught some games before my season started, our independencies.
There's a bunch of people listening that have no idea what the hell those things are. Explain for anyone that's 12 years old what the hell you're talking about.
First off, I went into the Fightin' store in this a family thought I was someone famous and they took a whole bunch of pictures of me in the Fightin' store. Let's just say that.
Okay.
So these necklaces were supposed to increase the flow of red blood cells to
areas. They're like the mid-2000s equivalent of those copper things
Charles Barkley would wear it and everything. Too.
But yeah. Right now, Brett Favre is hawking some like copper-infused like sweatpants or something, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing now.
It's similar.
So it's the mid-2000s version of like the copper-infused crap that everybody's selling at the moment.
So they had wristbands. The necklaces were most common. You saw a lot of major leaguers in that time would rock like double and triple necklaces. So I had already had one. And I was up at the store, and they sucker you in. They do this test. They're like, try to lift this water bottle with one hand, and you can't do it. And then it's like, put the Fightin' around your wrist and lift it up. And it's like through the roof and all this stuff. All right, I'm sold. It's like, I don't know. If it might help my recovery as a pitcher, sure, I'll throw a few on. Then they had these little dots, these like stickers you put on, kind of like the tape.
Mm-hmm.
So you put the sticker. I'd put them like right on my shoulder and all that stuff, and they're all red after. It's like, oh, yeah, look at this recovery. Got to have my Fightin' recovery. It was great.
Yeah.
So that was 07.
So yeah, there's a picture of you somewhere laden
double
down
fighting
with this crap.
Because I had one, and then I got like their super premium one at the Fightin' store.
Of course, yeah.
Up in Seattle.
And that's the really good recovery.
All right, let's get into some football stuff.
The charity drive.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, the charity drive.
So in order to get me dressing up like idiot minor league Steve over there,
here's what we can do. Pin tweet at
PFF_Sam and donate money to the kids.
I have an idea.
The Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Here's what we'll do.
What?
We will have you pose and replicate one of my baseball cards too. So we'll have you try to pitch and replicate my pitching motion while you're in the uniform.
That one looks easy.
And we'll have we've got a great social media team here. We've got some very talented people over here at PFF. By the way, we're hiring a whole bunch of people too. So go check that out, pff.com. Very talented people who can maybe superimpose you onto a baseball card.
I mean, that looks easy enough. You're just, you know, that's...
Oh, yeah. Piece of cake.
Yeah.
It's easy.
I mean, to be honest, the hardest part of replicating that will be the fact that I'll be doing it in shoes 8 times too big for me.
Oh, it's going to be great. Yeah, so go check out at PFF_Sam, pinned tweet for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
We're over $500 right now. 505 is what we're at.
We're at 5? Oh, that's good.
Somebody gave $100. Somebody generous soul.
Wow, we are really moving. Somebody really wants to see you look...
Ben Strauss, like apparently, donated $100.
Thank you, Ben.
Good for him.
So shout out there. So go check out at PFF_Sam. All right, let's get into this Bears quarterback situation. It was on the Chris Collinsworth podcast. I was a guest last week. Chris had to go to the bottom of the barrel and grab Matt Nagy, the Bears head coach, as his follow-up guest after me. I know the numbers aren't going to be nearly as good as when I was on the show, but, you know, Matt Nagy, Bears are hot right now, you know. Talking a lot about the Bears. They went from this unexciting offseason with Andy Dalton as the starter to now drafting Justin Fields. So Chris, I thought Chris did a great job in the interview, asking all the right questions. He told Matt, he's like, I'm going to butter you up a little bit, then get into the hard-hitting questions about Justin Fields, and he did that. And the takeaway was on Twitter.
Does that work if you tell them? Isn't the idea that you're supposed to do that?
Yeah, that's how we do it. You tell the truth. Chris is stealing from us.
Okay.
You don't use techniques. You just tell the truth.
I thought it might have been like, you know, when you have to explain a joke, it's not as funny.
Yeah, maybe.
Like when you have to tell them, hey, I'm gonna offer some misdirection over here, and then I'm going to hit you with the left.
Not if the execution's good.
Okay.
And Chris executed. Very well done interview. And the whole time when the news came out, Chris was cringing. He's like, we got you guys. Week one, Sunday Night Football, and you're telling me Andy Dalton's going to be the starter. But that was the news, right? Matt Nagy says, let's just tee it up right now. Let's hear what Matt Nagy had to say about the Justin Fields, Andy Dalton situation.
And so the million-dollar question is, well, when's it going to be? Is it going to be in training camp? Is it going to be in the first game of the year? Is it going to be the seventh game, the end of the year? Is it next year? You know, for us, we put together this plan, and the plan is that Andy is the starter.
All right, Sam, your thoughts now on what Matt Nagy said, because everybody flipped out, and I've got thoughts on it. What is your initial reaction?
I have a few thoughts. One, he's only guaranteeing him a gig week one. It's not like, you know, Justin Fields is never seeing the field in his rookie season.
Thank you.
It's like week one, Andy Dalton will be starting. And from then on in, it's dependent on how Andy Dalton plays, how long he's going to be in that job.
He didn't say that.
No,
he did not say that. And that's the issue. He did not say it has anything to do with Andy Dalton.
But that's the reality.
It does not have anything to do with Andy Dalton.
Of course it does.
It has everything to do with Justin Fields.
It has everything to do with Andy Dalton.
Does not.
The every single one of these rookie quarterbacks for whom the plan is to sit and learn, the time that they get on the field is determined entirely by the quality of play of the starting quarterback. So I was talking about this yesterday. I don't think that the Chiefs were planning on sitting Patrick Mahomes for his entire rookie season. If I remember rightly, their bye week that year was somewhere in the middle of the year. I bet they would have been targeting that season saying, hey, Alex Smith starts, Patrick Mahomes is going to sit behind him, learn from the bench, and then like week nine or whatever it is, we get the bye. After then, we can throw in Mahomes and we can start rolling with a, you know, real quarterback. But Alex Smith had a career year, led the league in deep passing, led the league in passer rating, whatever it was. Alex Smith played so well that you couldn't take him off the field. So even though they knew that they had Patrick Mahomes sitting back there ready to light the league on fire, they're like, oh, you can't sit this guy down. He's playing this well. If Andy Dalton has an Alex Smith season this year, Justin Fields probably won't see the field. I don't think Andy Dalton's capable of having that kind of season. So I don't think it's going to happen. But the point is, the difference between the Alex Smith season that we'll see Fields consigned to the bench for 17 games, and Justin Fields being on the field in week three is how well Andy Dalton plays. If Andy Dalton just absolutely lays an egg for the first 2 weeks, they're going to hook him off the field. Justin Fields flies in. If Andy Dalton has a career year, leads the league in passer rating, looks phenomenal, takes the Bears to the playoffs, Justin Fields won't be on the field.
Maybe. I'm not hearing that from Nagy, though. I heard everything through the lens of Justin Fields. And here's what drives me nuts is this quote goes out there on Twitter, and it is like a race. And the quote is essentially, Andy Dalton's our starter. And then Chris did dig in because Chris, you know, they've got Sunday Night Football week one. Chris doesn't want Andy Dalton as the starting quarterback for the Bears. He's like, man, I want Justin Fields. I want to sell this thing. And Matt Nagy guaranteed that Andy Dalton would be the starter. And that was the quote that kind of went viral,
yeah,
right?
But that's my other feeling about this is we're starting to reach a point where, like, how bad do people think Andy Dalton is at this stage? Like, Andy, like, it's not this catastrophic, disastrous joke of a decision if Andy Dalton is your starting quarterback to begin the year.
He is the best quarterback that they've played. He is the best quarterback they've had in how long?
Yeah, a long time. Andy Dalton is not a disaster at quarterback. Now, last season didn't do a whole lot to enhance his reputation, but look, the way that this is being treated, it's like Justin Fields is a superstar and Andy Dalton is like an embarrassment of a quarterback stealing money from the Bears for even having a job. Andy Dalton can start games for a good team and be okay. He is not a catastrophe at quarterback there have been many, many significantly worse starting quarterbacks in the NFL than Andy Dalton. And the hysteria around this thing at the moment, I mean, it's getting, like, if you're Andy Dalton looking at this, you've got to be, like, asking yourself, how bad do people think I am?
I have a bigger issue. The bigger issue that I have, and by the way, Andy Dalton, every one of his, you know, he's only got two grades. He hasn't graded worse than what Mitch Trubisky has graded in a season since 2012. Dalton's first 2 years were just, you know, below average, and he hasn't graded that low. So he's better than what they were trotting out there in Trubisky, better than what Nick Foles showed last year. My bigger issue is, you know, I've taken a little break from social media, but when I dabbled back in there a couple days ago, and you see this quote going around, and then it's like a race to quote tweet it with some sort of snark or, you know, stay bad Bears or you idiot Bears. You know, this is why you've got no plan. What do you think? This is everybody saying, how could you possibly start Andy Dalton when you just drafted Justin Fields? And even if you're the biggest Justin Fields fan, we're fans of Justin Fields. We ranked him third in our quarterback rankings. We think he was, you know, should not have gone as low as he did, that other teams missed on the ability to draft Justin Fields. But I completely respect what Matt Nagy actually said. And for all the hot take artists out there that just needed to quote tweet, oh, you idiot Bears, including probably some people at PFF. I didn't see everybody that did that. Probably had some people that did it. It was a race to quote tweet and get your take out there at how stupid the Bears are, when I actually think everything Matt Nagy said was really, really smart. And he was there during the Mahomes, Alex Smith thing. That's what he kept reiterating.
Yeah.
And he also didn't say, just because I had Mahomes sit for 16 weeks and then play week 17, that's not the plan. The plan is, it's what's best for Justin Fields. Mm. The plan is, we want him to sit. And to your point, you nailed it, right? Like, he just guaranteed week one. He never went in there and said, Andy Dalton's our starter. Earn it, Justin Fields. You know, you gotta pry it away from Andy's, you know, dead, lifeless hands. He just said, Andy Dalton's our starter for week one. We're doing what's best for Justin Fields, which is the right answer.
Sure.
You do what's best for your quarterback long term. And it could be week two, it could be week 17. Who knows?
Yeah. But I also think that those plans are entirely dependent on the play of the starter. Like,
I don't think the intention is, but I do think you do.
The intention never is.
You do have a compelling history of, yeah,
the plans change.
Yeah, the plan does change.
Blake Bortles, right? Now, one of the big differences, so Blake Bortles was a guy that desperately needed to sit his entire first year and figure out how the hell to play quarterback at the NFL level. He was a raw prospect coming in, and the Jags said all the way through that offseason, he's going to be sitting year one. And then it lasted, like, what, 3 weeks of Chad Henne before Blake Bortles was thrown to the Wolves. Now, Andy Dalton is a lot better than Chad Henne, so you shouldn't have that degree of pressure coming down on you. But the point is, if the starting quarterback plays badly enough, you can't not put in the rookie. Like, it takes an incredible amount of determination in the face of fan pressure. And bear in mind that this is a staff, coach, and GM that can't ride through that kind of pressure right now. Maybe at the start of their tenure, they would have been able to. But right now, if the crap starts coming down on them because the team sucks and the starter's playing bad and you have Justin Fields sitting on the bench, I do not think that this is a group that can ride through that storm and say, look, we're doing the best thing for Justin Fields. He's not ready. They're going to have to put him in. But it's all down to how Andy Dalton plays. If he plays reasonably well, Andy Dalton has the same career interception rate, okay, different eras, but as Joe Montana and Steve Young.
Oh, stop it, Sam. Why?
Also, Peyton Manning, Tony Romo, you know, a bunch of more modern quarterbacks. He isn't the catastrophe people are making him out to be.
I mean, I know he's not a catastrophe. I know that.
Also, Ben Roethlisberger, like a bunch of modern quarterbacks as well, but, you know, two Hall of Famers, three Hall of Famers, Peyton Manning.
I mean, the Bears have made the playoffs two out of the last 3 years. Trubisky's pretty much been
terrible quarterback play.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance that Dalton plays well there. And I don't want to be completely fooled. I thought Andy Dalton would play better with Dallas last year.
Agreed.
The offensive line was in rough shape. And the Bears have some questions on their offensive line as well. By the way, we're going to talk a lot about offensive lines on the show, too. I didn't even tease that. But
Dalton did kind of get it together later in that year, though.
Yeah, he did.
It was a terrible start.
And week 17 was rough.
Yeah.
Playoffs were on the line.
But then it kind of got, you know, the back end wasn't terrible.
My issue, I'm overreacting to people overreacting. That's all. I just think it's a society problem, Sam. Oh, people see a quote and they don't even care about the context. They just there is just a rush to get your hot take out there in response to a snippet of what was said. And the actual stuff that was said by Matt Nagy on the Chris Collinsworth podcast was absolutely fine.
That's why you've got that Twitter button where it's like, do you want to read the article before you quote tweet it? To which the answer is never yes. The answer is always no. I just want to hit the
button. It honestly doesn't even matter. I've seen people post actual videos with text that doesn't match what's on the video, and people only respond to the text.
It's the caption. Yeah, nobody's watching the video. It's just the caption that you're putting out there.
Anyway, so I agree with the Bears' plan, which is do what's best for Justin Fields. And if there's a debate about what is best for Justin Fields, I think there's a legitimate debate. You know, there's a history of guys starting week one. There's a history of guys sitting out an entire season. There's a history of a Patrick Mahomes sitting out 16 weeks of the season and playing one game. There's a history of successes and failures when it comes to what you do with your quarterback. And I just respect if the Bears, as long as the Bears' decision-making process is through the lens of Justin Fields, not necessarily through the lens of Andy Dalton. And to your point, sometimes you do get swayed by what the veteran's doing, but do what's best for your starter. Even the Jags. The Jags said, we don't have a starting quarterback yet. They're just saying the stuff. Yeah. But, you know, Trevor Lawrence is almost certainly going to be.
Vegas doesn't even have a market on that not being Trevor Lawrence.
They're not buying into that.
They're not even taking bets on the idea that anybody other than Lawrence
is starting. Gardner Minshew is our starter. They're not going to come out and say,
well, Gardner can't be the starter. He cut his hair. The mullet's gone.
Yeah, he's lost all his power.
Right.
By the way, PFF has partnered with Symbol, that's S-I-M-B-U-L-L, the stock market for sports that allow you to trade sports teams like stocks and earn cash payouts when your teams win. You might actually decide to invest in the Bears or, you know, sell the Bears based off of the Chris Collinsworth podcast and what Matt Nagy said. Symbol has blended sports and the stock market to offer you a new way to invest and profit off your favorite teams or even the Bears. MLB's in full swing for the rest of the summer. You can earn daily cash payouts. NFL free agency still kind of going on. We still see a few signings here and there, and that can move the needle. Use promo code PFF. Deposit $10 at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free PFF annual subscription. That's promo code PFF with a $10 deposit at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free annual subscription. All right, I initially wanted to call this the offensive line extravaganza. I wanted to talk some O-line. While you were gone, we put out our offensive line rankings. I wrote it up, over 10,000 words. They told me that was too wordy, Sam. That was too much.
Yeah.
So we're going to cut back next time.
I can see why they think that.
Well, people only want to go read their team. So each team deserves full love in the offensive line rankings.
Okay.
But we also got a couple good questions about the offensive line as well. You want to get into those? Or do you want to look into at the rankings at all?
You lead on, Steve.
All right. I'll do this. So this is from Mike. I'll have to find the email address. Hello, Steve and Sam. Big fan of the show and listen to every episode. So this is Raiders-driven here. I wanted to ask about the Raiders' moves on their offensive line in replacing Rodney Hudson, Gabe Jackson, and Trent Brown. With respect to the team-building concept you reference often, all three of these players were being paid among the top 10 players at their position, but were either consistently unavailable, Trent Brown, or slipping in production, Gabe Jackson, and he said Trent Brown, but I think he meant Rodney Hudson. Hudson was graded as the worst run-blocking center in 2020, and his pressure rate tripled from 2019. All fair points. Gabe Jackson was also graded poorly in the run game in 2020 and had an even higher pressure rate than Hudson. Given these statistics, wouldn't replacing them with cheaper, younger players be seen as a positive team-building strategy? Appreciate the countless hours of entertainment while I'm pretending to work. So I appreciate Mike, dedicated listener. It's an astute question. So he's asking us, Sam, essentially to maybe take a second look at our offseason Raiders analysis where we said, man, they've reshaped this offensive line. Perhaps we didn't put enough thought. We didn't discuss enough the fact that they're cutting massive salaries in Rodney Hudson, Gabe Jackson, and Trent Brown. But so I want to get your thoughts. But my initial point is yes, and you're going to go with cheaper, younger players, but that doesn't necessarily mean your offensive line is going to be better. So if we're just talking about going into next year, I still don't see how the Raiders get better. I'll address some of the regression, too, with some of those guys in a minute.
I think it's also a institutional, structural mistake to do it. Like, if you have an offensive line, you should be constructing it in such a way that you aren't going to have to face at any point the idea of having to turn over
all of
three-fifths or four-fifths of it in one offseason, right? So, okay, they're getting Richie Incognito back, but he was a free agent, like they had to bring him back. And then they've gotten rid of three-fifths of the starters. So essentially, four out of five guys on this offensive line were going to be gone this offseason. They brought back one of them who's old and, you know, at some point is going to decline. Colton Miller getting his big extension is the one guy they were going to have held over. So if you're walking into a situation where you're replacing that much of your offensive line, you're already bad. Like, that's already a mistake, regardless of what you're doing to replace it. It's just too much. Now, you know, you can look at the Raiders and say, well, they've made a lot of bad decisions in the past. This is a fundamental problem with what they're doing. It's bad. Then you look at the Chiefs and you're like, well, the Chiefs are perennial Super Bowl contenders. They got Patrick Mahomes, and you don't give them the same attention. I would argue that both, they're very similar, right? The Raiders offensive line, complete overhaul. The Chiefs offensive line, complete overhaul. And you probably wouldn't see it phrased or framed the same way. I think you would see a lot more criticism sent the Raiders way than you would Kansas City. But to me, it's a similar problem in terms of you just shouldn't allow yourself to have to hit that many moves on the offensive line at one time to maintain a certain level.
Part of the issue. So let me address the regression here. Did Rodney Hudson regress last year? Yes. His pressure rate was, I mean, he allowed more pressures last year than his previous 3 years, right? I mean, so it wasn't nearly as good last year. However, I think there is a point where players tend to drop off. And we've mentioned this with a guy like AJ Green, but I think from an offensive line perspective, you don't tend to hit a cliff as much as you do at, say, a skill position or a position where your speed and athleticism will be sapped and you'll lose it, right? Like, an offensive line, you can, like, if Rodney Hudson bounces back and he's the best pass protecting center in the league this year, I wouldn't be surprised. If AJ Green bounces back and is a top 10 receiver again, I would be shocked, right? So I would look at Rodney Hudson's regression last year and say, okay, he had a bad year, but there is a massive track record of success here as a pass blocker. Yeah, he's an okay run blocker, but it's a downgrade, right? And then the guys that are replacing him, Nick Martin has similar splits as a good pass blocker, below average run blocker. So there's no way Nick Martin or Andre James, who they like and all that stuff. Andre James, 3 years of just mediocre grading at UCLA, well below average grading on about 120 snaps in the NFL. It is very hard pressed to say, to look at the Raiders' center position and think it's going to be better
Hudson's,
this year.
Hudson's run blocking, by the way, last year was fine. It was 72.7.
Oh, so I got suckered into...
Lies?
I thought it was better than that, but I bought into what he said.
Fake news
and
misinformation.
So either way, Rodney Hudson is a downgrade. Gabe Jackson, I think it is fair to look at, you go to Premium Stats and you have PFF Elite and you check it out, right? He's gotten worse every single year. That's fair. And maybe for the price and, you know, hey, Russell Wilson's excited. But Denzel Good, also, Denzel Good's best years aren't better than Gabe Jackson's worst years. So it's you know, through our lens, it's tough to say that they upgraded at right guard.
Yeah, like, any one of the moves they made is entirely justifiable and makes sense. Just the fact that you needed to do all three of them at the same time is the problem. Like, it's not any one of those moves. I honestly think you can make a good case for each one of them. It's just doing all three at the same time is a problem, because now you've got to replace three-fifths of an offensive line in a league that has an offensive line problem. This is the same issue that the Jets ran into last year, right? You did the right thing in terms of throwing bodies at the problem, but the idea that all of those are going to hit in the one offseason is just not going to happen, and it didn't. Like, you know, we ran the math on how likely it was for all of those guys to come good, and you suddenly have a fixed offensive line, and it wasn't very likely at all. And the Jets' offensive line was better, but it wasn't fixed, and that's the problem that the Raiders are going to have, and it's a risk for the Chiefs.
Trent Brown, he was a starting right tackle. He barely played last year. He's being replaced by Alex Leatherwood. Trent Brown's an interesting case because he's generally been a good, solid tackle. He's a good player. He's also moved around a bunch. I don't know. I think people maybe didn't want him in their building at various times, even though he's going back to New England. So if Trent Brown was healthy and you were projecting his play versus rookie Alex Leatherwood's play, you would probably lean toward Trent Brown being the better player. So again, there's always an opportunity that Leatherwood comes good and Denzel Good becomes better and Nick Martin or Andre James is a pretty good center. But again, on paper, did they cut a lot of salary? Yes. Did they get better on paper at any of those three positions? No. So it's hard to get excited about that. And to your point, I think your point's the best one. it's all of this happening at the same time instead of, you know, one piece here and there. You know, the Colts have been able to keep 4/5 of their offensive line intact, and they handled a retirement situation because they just, you know, at left tackle, they just needed to sign one player. But I thought it was an astute question as far as, you know, it's not as simple as losing good players bad. I mean, there is salary to cut, and there are salary cap issues around the league. Someone else asked. There's another listener of the week. This is Dylan. Hello, friends. I've been a big fan of you guys for the last few seasons and have used PFF's data to dominate my fantasy league in bets. And that's what it's all about here, fellas. Use PFF to win fantasy and bets. Oh, that reminds me why we're here. It's a perfect transition. Underdog Fantasy. If you like fantasy football and if you like playing fantasy for money, you need to check out Underdog. Underdog Fantasy has everything, including season-long and playoff best ball. Best ball is a season-long game where you draft a team like you normally do, but that's it. No in-season roster management. Underdog automatically selects your best performers each week, saving you loads of time. So you can draft right now. Go to Underdog Fantasy, deposit $10, use the promo code PFF, get a free PFF Edge annual subscription. Promo code PFF, draft now at Underdog Fantasy. That was all natural, Sam.
You can't just transition into an ad read in the middle of an email.
No, that's what you do. You just
that's disrespecting a
listener's
email.
This is instincts. Dylan's helping us sell a little Underdog Fantasy. He's okay with that. He's probably going to sign up with his email. That's instincts. When he talks about dominating his fantasy league and bets using PFF data, boom, insert Underdog Fantasy read.
Yeah.
Get it in there the first half of the show because that's what you want. You got to do it first half of the show. Huh. That's what we do here. Anyway, Dylan's a longtime listener. He knows the pitch of the goal is to have an average offensive line that I always say. But what does that mean exactly? So he wants us to essentially define creep back toward average. Is the goal to rank 10 to 15th every year? Is the goal to average an overall offensive line grade of 72? Because if it's the overall rank, could that not fluctuate with each season? An offensive line that ends the year at an 80 grade, in theory, could be considered top 5 one season, then another season be around 10th. Also, what data should people look at to determine if an offensive line fits the ideal average? Thank you for your time, Dylan. So he's got some fair questions. How would you describe creep back toward average?
Not having a catastrophic weak link anywhere in your starting five.
Or if you do,
nope.
Having enough stars
nope.
To cover it.
No. Nope.
Really?
Don't want them. Don't want the weak link. Don't give me one. Give me five random guys that are going to be okay. I don't want the weak link.
So that should be the goal. I think that is the goal. And you know what? Who epitomizes that has been the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Pittsburgh Steelers, over the last 5 or 6 years, have had the great Alejandro Villanueva at left tackle. They've had a revolving door at right tackle. Guys like Marcus Gilbert, Matt Filer, you know, the famous Matt Filer here in the PFF NFL podcast. David DeCastro, Marquise Pouncey. Friend of the show, Ramon Foster's been, you know, was there a few years ago. If you look at that starting offensive line over the years, you would generally say you've got this hypothetical Hall of Famer in Marquise Pouncey, who's a league average center.
Hypothetical.
You've got David DeCastro, who might be the star of the offensive line, and he's a top 8, top 10 guard generally in the NFL, and everyone else is just pretty good. But they have ranked top 5. They were first in our offensive line rankings 1 year.
Yeah.
Because they had 5 average players. So
better than average for most of it.
Well, I'm saying average as far as like they're all top 15 at their position.
Yeah, I mean, they're right? A good example of a team that didn't have a weak link. They were better than that. They actually got significantly higher. But the majority of the time, the Steelers' offensive line was really good because nobody was a problem.
I would say the superstar player, though, is valuable. Because you know, you were talking against this with the Penei Sewell thing. The superstar is valuable depending on how low you're coming from. I've used this example millions of times. When the Seahawks had George Fant fresh off the basketball court protecting Russell Wilson's blind side, when you upgrade to Dwayne Brown, top 10 left tackle, that is a massive upgrade. When you have Julian Davenport and you upgrade to Laremy Tunsil, and Laremy Tunsil cuts the pressure rate at left tackle in, you know, a third, he gives up a third of the pressures as Julian Davenport, that actually takes an offensive line from bottom tier to at least mid tier, just from a pass blocking standpoint. So the thing I would say is, the goal is to have no weak links. If you run into a situation where there might be a weak link, the better you have a player somewhere else, it kind of offsets things, does it not?
I don't know if it offsets things. I think it's just you're talking about those are that left tackle is still, I think, the most important position along the offensive line. Even though left tackle, right tackle, it's fairly interchangeable. I think generally speaking, that is still the most important position. At which point, if you have a massive weakness at your left tackle spot and you're able to upgrade to a Pro Bowler, it makes a big difference. I don't think it's necessarily. So look at the Seahawks as an example, right? They massively upgraded by getting Dwayne Brown. It did catapult that offensive line and move it forward leaps and bounds. But when they run into the Rams twice a year, Aaron Donald lays waste to that offensive line because their guards suck. Dwayne Brown doesn't offset anything there. He's just like doing his job while the guys inside are lying face first on the floor with Aaron Donald laying waste to the backfield every play. So I don't think it necessarily offsets anything. I think it can make a huge difference for that one specific position. But where the Seahawks have failed is that they haven't been able to get everybody up to that baseline of adequate. Now, Aaron Donald would, you know, wreck adequate pretty well as well, but he absolutely destroys not adequate.
I think the Vikings epitomize that a little bit. I thought, say what you want, they paid a lot of money for Riley Reiff and for Mike Remmers a few years back.
I think they've tried to get it and just haven't managed it.
Well, strategically, I thought it was the right play. I mean, Reiff and Remmers are perfect mid-tier type of tackles, but they had a similar issue, right? A mid-tier tackle is still going to get whooped a couple times a year, right? And you still got that from Mike Remmers and you got that from Riley Reiff. But then the interior has been the bigger issue. Like, their left guard has been a disaster year in, year out in Minnesota, and center they haven't figured out with Pat Elflein and Garrett Bradbury. So I think that's part of it too. You know, the Steelers offensive line looks good because the Steelers tackles weren't necessarily better than maybe the Vikings tackles a few years ago, but the Vikings had weaknesses elsewhere and it makes everything else look worse. So I do think that's the goal, right? Is to have as few weaknesses as possible. I think the question that's posed, do you want to rank 10th to 15th? Do you want to grade at 72? There's definitely not like a grade baseline. But if you can avoid ranking below 15th or so, certainly below, not below 20th, from a pass blocking standpoint. So just looking from a pass blocking standpoint, when you're in the 20s, it's tough to run an offense. It is tough to run third and long, to play on third and long, right? It is just tough to protect your quarterback. So I don't want a team that's going to rank below 20th, below 15th, but certainly not below 20th from a pass blocking standpoint. And then I would say on the other end, run blocking has a bigger impact on your run game. So I think it is actually more valuable to have a top five run blocking offensive line, because you can elevate, if you're going to run the ball, you can elevate your running backs and everything else around you. So I think it's not so much creep back to average from a run blocking standpoint, but you can do fine with a mid-tier offensive line, but if you do have a good one, you can benefit from it greatly.
It also depends what kind of scheme you're running. Like, it's some offensive line, or some offenses are able to elevate the play of their offensive linemen by essentially making their jobs easier and not asking them to do as many difficult things. So Baltimore will make a lineman look better than he does in most other places. San Francisco, I think, is a similar idea. So those guys can kind of take worse offensive linemen generally and get away with it more than other teams can. So it doesn't really change much in terms of what you're trying to achieve. It just means that your baseline is slightly higher just by default, because of what you're running. Whereas, you know, certain other teams that are running a scheme that doesn't do that, you actually need to find better players, because potentially you're taking a lineman from a scheme like that who you think is better than he is, and then in your scheme the guy looks a lot worse. And I think that might be a little bit of what the Vikings struggled with for a while, and the Chargers, and these teams that have made a lot of moves that on paper made some sense and just didn't work out. I think part of it is because they were in a slightly more difficult situation and they therefore didn't do as well.
I think that's a really key point too. And I think, I can't remember if it was the old Browns axioms that were making its way around the internet and all that stuff, but I think it was essentially understand your scheme advantage. And it's an important one. It's something we've talked about here too, right? Ravens seem to be a good one, right? They either make their offensive linemen more productive, or they make their edge rushers more productive, whatever it might be. So taking advantage of that, whether it is in free agency or whether it is the ability to have lesser players, but that's because You have to have a Lamar Jackson to make that work. You have to have an Aaron Donald that's going to help your edge. But you have to have a scheme or a superstar advantage that makes other things around. But just having that awareness, I do think, is important. You want to wrap it up with some offensive line rankings here?
Sure. What do you got?
I did my monologue, Sam. I did 30 minutes on the top five and the bottom five and broke it down. Giants, I had to rank 32nd.
Whew.
I didn't love it. I think there's potential for them to be better. But it's tough to just look up and down that offensive line and say, okay, improvement across the board. Right? They have a chance, but on paper, I think the Giants had to be last, just ahead of the Panthers at 31.
Yeah. The Giants' offensive line is massively concerning. Like, we're looking into the season and saying, hey, this is a make-or-break year for Daniel Jones, and it's huge for him and therefore Dave Gettleman and everybody in charge. Like, Daniel Jones, that offensive line might be bad enough that Jones doesn't really have a shot. Like, we were expecting this big jump from him because he suddenly got some receivers to play with, and that group overall, talent-wise, in the skill positions actually looks pretty good. But that offensive line is going to be bad. And if it's that bad, like, almost no quarterback can do well.
Well, he had the Bears at 27th. It's another thing that Matt Nagy addressed on the Chris Collinsworth podcast. You know, he said, hey, Jermaine Ifedi's slotted in at right tackle. He played some good football down the stretch last year. And again, it's just tough to buy into the track record. You know me, Mr. Offensive lineman improve in years 4, 5, and 6. You know, you see those improvements. I don't know if we've seen enough from Jermaine Ifedi. And then Tevin Jenkins, the rookie, is going to play left tackle. I would feel better if it was Charles Leno still there and Tevin Jenkins. They had to make a salary cap decision on Leno. I'd feel better. And Leno's not great, but he's good enough, right? I would feel better if it was Leno and Jenkins and Ifedi's playing guard rather than having Tevin Jenkins and then Ifedi as your two starting tackles.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom 5, 10 teams on this list, it's like offensive lines that could derail an otherwise pretty good-looking team and season. Number 30 is Miami. And again, Tua, make-or-break year for Tua. The 5 interceptions in a rainstorm in minicamp or whatever the hell we're in right now.
Speaking of overreaction.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in a second. But like, Tua is on the hot seat. The Dolphins are kind of on the hot seat because they have this great roster and they've sort of deliberately turned down the opportunity to get back into the quarterback market this offseason, instead saying, no, it is Tua. We believe in this guy. He's going to be the dude. And the offensive line, they didn't really do much to make that better either. It was like, we have a bunch of young guys that played last year. We expect a leap from them, and that's what offensive linemen tend to do, get better year 2, year 3. So we didn't do a whole lot to make this offensive line better. And you might be right, but if you're not, you're screwed. Like, everything is gone to hell. Now, if this offensive line is as bad as it was last year, you're going to end up at the end of the year and you're going to have no idea what Tua is. The best case scenario is you don't know because you haven't given him the opportunity yet because the line was bad enough. The worst case is you actually get led astray and you say Tua isn't good enough and it was only because the offensive line was bad enough. And you end up starting over, Tua goes somewhere else, looks great, and it was just because you didn't invest in the offensive line again when you had more than enough picks to make that happen.
If you're a Dolphins fan and you're screaming at your YouTube or your wherever you listen to us from a podcast standpoint, screaming at us that these young players are going to get better next year, you might want to point to the Rams.
I mean, they might, but they might not.
I'm just saying, you might want to point to the Rams last year at this time where we were struggling, saying, how did the Rams go from one of the best offensive lines to one of the worst in 2019? It was tough to rank the Rams high based off what we had just seen the previous year. Perhaps we should have taken in previous years into account more. But actually what happened with the Rams is their young players that they had invested in 2 and 3 years prior did take steps forward. Austin Corbett, David Edwards, Rob Havenstein bounced back.
Yeah.
And Andrew Whitworth played like one of the best left tackles in the league again after he looked like he was regressing. That would be the difference, though, with the Rams. They had some youth get better, but they had pillars at tackle who were previously among the best at their respective positions, and they got back on track as veterans. That would be the difference. Miami's banking on all the youth to get better, and including potentially, you know, rookies and Liam Eikenberg.
And it might happen, but it's a big risk. And for a team like Miami that has built this stockpile of draft picks, that's a team that could have just increased their chances of that happening, right? You just take another couple of offensive linemen, and you're going to increase the chances that somewhere in the starting five is a good offensive line. You want to hit the Tua thing quickly? Guy threw five picks in practice, and everybody's losing their minds.
Because people are stupid, Sam.
Well, here's the thing. So, number one, did you see the weather at the time? It was a Miami, Florida monsoon of rain. So, of course, there's going to be interceptions. Like, it's a freaking rainstorm. Everybody throws interceptions in a rainstorm. Number two, Tua's biggest problem as a rookie was having the lowest big-time throw rate in the NFL. Brian Flores has come out and said, we are going to keep him aggressive all the way through the offseason. Abso-freaking-lutely. Yes. They should be saying, look, you are going to be hyper-aggressive through training camp, through mini camp, through preseason, and if we need to dial it back when we hit week one, we can do that. But we need to move your needle from like zero over here all the way back over here somewhere so that it ends up in the middle, right? You were the lowest quarterback in the NFL at making aggressive big plays down the field. You're going to go all the way to the other side of the spectrum while it doesn't count. And if it costs you a million interceptions in preseason, who gives a crap? They don't count. When we get to week one, we can maybe pull you back to the middle so that now we're somewhere normal. But we can't go from nothing to like a league average level by just saying, do what you do and see how it works out. I think that's a really smart thing to say, be as aggressive as humanly possible right now while it doesn't count. And we can make you less aggressive. That's easy. Making you more aggressive is a hell of a lot harder. So that's what we got to spend all the time doing.
One of the big time throws that he did have was against Kansas City. He threw a ball that he probably shouldn't even have thrown to Mike Gesicki up the seam, but it was incredible. I mean, he was covered over the top and in man coverage, and he put it right on him. But it was one of those, it was that type of play that almost allowed the Dolphins to upset the Chiefs. And that's what they're going for. So people are stupid though, Sam. Let's just start. even if it was an actual football game where a guy threw five interceptions, of course what we do here at PFF is put context to that. Were those passes dropped? Were they actual bad decisions? How many passes did he actually make at training camp? Did he throw 50? Did he throw 100? Did he throw 200? Did he throw 200 and only had five picks? I don't know. There's zero context here. What happened on those interceptions? And then your point, what are they actually working on? What are they trying to do? Aaron Rodgers said this all the time, right? He's like, I always tried to make throws that I couldn't make, that I wasn't going to normally make in a game, just to try because it's practice.
Wasn't it the first year that Mahomes was going to be starting where he threw like a million interceptions in training camp? And everyone was like, what the hell is happening here? And I think Mahomes or the Chiefs came out and said, like, we're trying to do all these crazy things that we're not, you know, we're like deliberately being risky. And so, yeah, we're throwing a whole bunch of interceptions. And then Mahomes comes out that year, like barely throws a pick the entire season, has an MVP year. And we're like, oh, yeah, okay. Probably shouldn't have overreacted. But like they exactly the same thing. They came out and said, look, we are being deliberately over-aggressive because, of course, you can wind that back in when you get to real games, but we want to see where the boundaries are. That, like, if the Dolphins are doing that with Tua, it's the smartest thing they could possibly be doing because he needs to get more aggressive from what we've seen from him.
I'm just going to sit here and be the voice of reason as all these
nobody wants to hear that.
All these supposed smart people overreact to every last tidbit that they see, from Matt Nagy to Tua. To the Etienne, whatever the French version is.
Etienne. Something like that.
The running back from Clemson playing wide receiver. Yeah. All right, I know it's June and you got nothing to do, but this is 12-month behavior, Twitter folks. Stop overreacting to every last thing. Now, if Tua comes out and throws 30 interceptions this year, you'd be like, hey, I told you back in minicamp.
Yeah.
Anyway. It's football. Coming. There's football happening. I love minicamps and training camp and the buzz. Everybody's in the best shape of their life. Jacob Harris is tearing it up at Rams camp. It's all happening.
Are you in the best shape of your life?
Oh, no. I am annually in the worst shape of my life. It is I'm progressively worse.
Definitely not in the best shape of my life.
Oh, I'm in way worse shape than I was last year.
Last year?
Yeah. Last year was bad compared to 2019.
That was like pandemic. 2019 was Like a little blip on the downslope because we'd been
when we were playing basketball, yeah, there was a little a slight uptick.
Yeah, like I'd gotten back to almost fit at that point.
I was like, I wasn't going to have a heart attack for a full court basketball game. There was a point where that happened.
Yeah.
I'm back to that.
I'd like lost the fat, hadn't got a gut at that point. I'd got some speed back.
Worst shape of my life.
I was almost there. And then, boom, pandemic hit.
It's like you're always looking for edges, right? I mean, it's like the draft. If every player loves football and you have 260 draft picks that love football, where's the edge? If everybody's in the best shape of their life going into the football season, there's no edge anymore.
My favorite stories are the guys that had like some kind of procedure in the offseason that's fixed everything, right? Like Troy Williamson.
Healthy for the first time in 15 years. Well,
Troy Williamson like had LASIK 1 year. It's like, oh, we can see now. He won't drop everything. Perfect. Done. Now we've got a receiver who's really fast, can get open, and won't drop the ball when it like lands in his hands 50 yards downfield against Denver. Like he's fixed. Remember Jameis? Jameis had LASIK, then he went out there through 30 interceptions.
I was going to say, did he have LASIK before the interception?
I think it was
year?
Before.
It wasn't.
No,
after.
Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was after that year, but before he went to the Saints. Yeah. And then
so we haven't really seen Jameis with LASIK,
we
right?
We haven't really seen Jameis being able to see yet. Yeah.
He didn't even see all those turnovers he had in 2019.
Yeah.
He didn't get to see him. I will say, I always showed up in great shape in spring training. I did show up in the best shape of my life every year.
Maybe you should have gone the other way. Just mailed it in the offseason, rolled up at 350 pounds, and just see how it worked.
I don't know if that would have been that great.
No?
I don't know. We had one guy showed up like 40 pounds heavier. He looked like he'd been, you know, like inflated. It was like, what'd you do this offseason, man?
Not much.
Yeah.
Sit on the couch.
You found the good stuff, huh?
Yeah.
I ate a lot to put my weight on. All right. That's it for us today. Great show. Great show, Sam. A lot of good stuff. Oh, no. We're gonna pass it off to
ourselves.
Yeah. I didn't. Yeah. Because we pre-recorded the video. I need to throw it to the video now in our interview.
This is not good.
You're very professional. It's the off-season for everybody.
This is weak. This is unprofessional.
Let's go.
Disappointing.
Now we're going to go to our highly publicized interview with a guy whose name I'll pronounce for the first time on this video. Mr. Leader, a man trying to earn an NFL kicking job.
All right. Let's welcome in a very special guest and... This is one you're going to enjoy, Steve. We have rugby interests on the podcast, and I thought it would be good for you to give a shot at pronouncing this guy's name because it's an Irish name. So, yeah. Why don't you welcome him in, Steve? Who we got?
Welcome in Mr. Leader.
Uh-huh. First name?
Oh, man. It's spelled T-A-D-H-G.
Uh-huh.
Is that an O sound in ta? I'll just spell it out. Ta? No. Tag? I'll just say.
Oh, you actually got
Todd.
Yeah.
That's kind of close. That's a lot closer than I thought you were getting.
Really?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it's actually closer. It's a lot closer than how you were getting when you were, you know, giving it a shot beforehand.
Well, because usually I'm like so far off, I decided to think outside the box.
Yeah. So that's at
Todd.
What is almost. It? Almost
Ty. Ty.
Yeah. Tyke.
Okay. Well, welcome in.
Tyke Leader.
Ty Leader.
So Tyke Leader is a former now rugby player. Who has played at an underage level for Ireland, then on the residency rule, played for the USA, and is now giving it a shot to make it as an NFL kicker.
Awesome.
Which is actually coincidentally perfect because we just spent half of last week's show talking about kickers and punters and how to, you know, cheat roster spots and how to, you know, use the experience of a lot of Australian Aussie rules skill set to translate to that. So Tyke is a perfect guy to bring on now. So why don't you, Tyke, tell us a little bit about the journey that you're on right now, this quest to make it to the NFL. You've been playing in the Spring League, right?
Yeah. So, well done on the pronunciation. When you mentioned an O, I was wondering where you're going to go with that. So
you should have heard some of the stuff he was giving a shot with, like when he first saw the name, some of the sounds coming out of his mouth they're not even close.
I told you, like, I've been so far off before, I decided maybe it's something crazy. So,
like there was no G sound in anything he was attempting to begin with. So we got a hell of a lot closer than I thought we were going to get.
Yeah, I was impressed. But for me, I've played my first ever game of football last month in the Spring League and up in the Colts Stadium, Lucas Oil. Unreal experience because, as I said, I've never played the sport, and then just kind of jumping in and with a lot of guys who've been in the league already and lot of D1 kind of football experience guys. It was, didn't know what to expect, but it was even more bizarre than whatever vision I had in my head. It was even more so just a pretty cool experience. But yeah, now I'm just trying to retire from professional rugby to give this a go. There hasn't exactly been a pathway to follow for me, because at least in my knowledge, I haven't really found anyone that's kind of done it like this. So it's been just trying to figure that out as I go. So the Spring League was a bit of a blessing to actually play the sport. And yeah, now 6 games into it, and just trying to just wrapped up all my footage and things of that nature, chatting to a few agents, trying to figure out, you know, the next step. As initially it was a kicker, but a punter got injured. My team asked me, can I punt? I said, yeah, sure, let's give it a go. And obviously I was just blagging, just kind of look at the Irish almost, that it went pretty decent. So now I'm kind of in that kind of kicker / punter realm to see what's next.
So it's been like talked about for years, this idea of sort of rugby players transitioning into football, but it's always talked about in terms of like superstar players, you know, like Dan Carter could be a kicker for somebody, Ron Nogara.
Of course.
Yeah, obviously, you know that, Steve.
Yeah.
But for someone of like your level, like you're saying, there's no pathway. There's no obvious guy saying, well, this guy is a clear superstar we could try bring in. So you've been doing this whole thing yourself and just trying to feel it out as you go.
Yeah, exactly. Like countless hours just, well, the first thing was to figure out, am I going to do this, I guess. And then once I guess to answer that question, I went out to John Kearney. You know, he's done it for 24 years in the league. I think he's the fifth or third top point scorer of all time. So he runs a kind of a kicking school out in San Diego. So once I was quite interested in kicking, and people were telling me I was good, but a lot of those people that are telling me I was good were, you know, no disrespect to them, but I don't think they'd seen what good looks like, what professional, what top end looks like. So out I went to John, just packed my bags, flew out from Boston out to San Diego. I was based in Boston at the time, and kicked with him for like 10 days. And the feedback was kind of, yeah, you're definitely at the level that you need to be. And considering you're so raw and new to this, like, it's pretty exciting where potentially could go. So hearing that from him was a huge kind of vote of confidence. And then, and to be honest, a big part was as well, from a professional rugby point of view, I ticked a lot of the box. Okay, no Dan Carter, no superstar, but I ticked a lot of the boxes that, you know, when I was a 10-year-old growing up in Ireland, if you told me I would have achieved what I achieved, I would be quite happy with it. So that maybe made the decision a little bit easier as well, that I was pretty content with my rugby career. And then on the back of the kind of advice and stuff from John, I just decided had to call my team, and I was still under contract, had to call my team and let them know, listen, I'm retiring to play a sport I've never played. So that was a bit of a strange one. My mates, my family, they were all a little bit like, what the hell are you doing? But thankfully, it's a really genuine, like, it's been class. The experience has been class so far. And I think it's just going to be the start of it.
You,
I need to know where in Boston you were staying. That's the important follow up there.
Obviously.
Yeah, Boston, Irish everywhere. But I was based, I moved around. I was in Watertown for a little bit out there, and then kind of Quincy, neck of the woods. So yeah, that's why. Are you a big Bostonian yeah. fan?
I'm more on the North Shore, North Reading. Yeah, I figured they would have just dropped you right in Southie, right, and just said here.
I've gone for plenty of pints in Southie, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
All right, you can have a real follow-up here, Sam.
Well, you sent us a video that we'll play in the back of this of you drop-kicking a football 60 yards. Was that how far it was?
Yeah, on the kickoff.
When, no, not the kickoff one. The kind of the trick shot one where you just take the ball, drop-kick it, and boot it 60 yards through the posts. That, like, the world lost its mind when Doug Flutie, you know, back in the day for the Patriots – drop kick like an extra point, which is what, like a 27-yard kick or something,
just because they haven't seen it,
right? But yeah, you know, it was considered this like miraculous, amazing thing, throwback to the olden days. Doug Flutie's incredible. he's out here booting double the length of
that. Better, he's better than Doug Flutie. Yeah, well, speaking of Boston legends, right?
How much, like, what kind of transferable skills are there from kicking a rugby ball to kicking a football?
So that's been the, I think, the exciting part of it is, alongside the, you know, the standard from a punting, hitting your spiral, or the rugby punt, or Aussie punt, as they call it. And then the kicking point of view, you know, just if you're from a field goal point of view, your foot to ball contact, if that's good, you're going to have a decent outcome. But what I've really enjoyed is, is like doing things outside the box, like your drop kick, or like, I think punters were very, a lot of punters, they're very, I don't know if robotics are the right word to use, but it's the mechanics is everything. And, you know, you walk the exact direction you're going to kick, and then you kick that way where your hips, your shoulders are aligned to the target that you want to go to. Whereas playing rugby, I'm used to, you know, having my hips and shoulders facing one way and then whipping my leg across the body and kicking another. And so there's cool, like loads of different things like that, that just from a ball striking perspective, because we're kicking and we're moving a lot of time. We're moving different directions. And so that's been something where in practice over the spring league, just doing like different style of kicks for fun on the sideline, and the guys with the coaches are watching and like, what the hell was that? Whereas, you know, in a rugby world, it would be like, oh, that's just, you know, it's just standard operation there. So, all the standard stuff is transferred pretty well. And then I'm hoping, yeah, that I can definitely do styles of kicks that would be deemed untraditional. I actually had a cool experience I was training up in San Diego with John Kearney, and then I was just doing some punting practice, and John Ryan, the former Seattle punter, was there as well, and he kind of came over to me, and, you know, I was punting to the left, but my hips were kind of pointing more towards the right, I guess, and he kind of came over to me, and like, I was well aware who he was at this point, and he was kind of watching me, and then I thought he was going to give me advice or tips, being like, whoa, you're doing this all wrong. I was hitting good balls, but like technique wise. And then he just kind of said to me, he was like, how the hell are you doing that? Like, how are you looking this way and kicking this way? Like, I want to learn how to do that, because that's going to mess up their returners back there, because the ball's going, your hips are going one way and the ball's going another. So that was pretty cool to kind of, to hear that from him. And trying to teach him how to, I guess, punt a little bit unorthodox was fun as well. So yeah, there's, playing rugby, it's opened up a lot of doors and kind of fun, different kicks that probably a lot of people haven't seen before.
I was going to say, there's probably an element to that that is beneficial, whether it is
well, that's why there was,
punting.
There was like a whole article written about Sam Cook, about how he had this arsenal of punts like that that just caused problems for the return team, because he would do stuff like that. He would open up in one direction, like hook the kick back in the other direction,
right,
and the guy's standing 25 yards in the wrong direction, right? Has to like scurry across the field to field it, let alone try and return it, and the return team being in the right place and all that kind of stuff. So like, Cook is being hailed as this, you know, pioneer and unique punter because he can do all this kind of stuff and has spent 10 years
and anybody can do
perfecting
it.
This
any
like,
rugby player
well perfecting the, you know, all those clubs in his bag.
Yeah,
and rugby kind of gives you that tool set like out of the box.
What about onside kicks too? I mean, just having, you know, there's a lot, there's part of onside kicks is, you know, loading it up one way, kicking it back the other way. So there's a little trickeration to it. It's much more limited than, you know, what, you know, the skill set that you would need for rugby. But I'm sure there's something there from an onside kick perspective as well.
Yeah. Well, just on that, you know, that kind of, I think Dallas Cowboys did it against Atlanta where the guy, the
what
kicker had to like trickle forward and like boomerang.
I named that, by the way. So if you can master that, it's called the hypnotizer.
Okay, well, yeah. I have something for you then.
Oh, yes.
I was doing, so the hypnotizer, but so I'm right-footed. So everything looking to the right. So I was getting myself set up. So I'm looking to my left as I approach, if that makes sense. And I was able to, so growing up, I was able to do the hypnotizer, but using my left foot. So using my other foot. So the guys in training and practice when I was setting it up, you know, everything was looking one way, my body shape, everything. And then I kind of just whipped it across using my other leg. And I remember the guys in that side of the fields were just like, you know, caught them by surprise big time. So the hypnotizer is one of the ones that hopefully, like, yeah, using either foot should definitely be an advantage. Whereas I think most kickers, obviously you use your dominant foot and they try and make like late changes, but you can kind of give away which way you're going to go based on your like the, which way you're obviously which way you're stacked. So the hypnotizer is one. Hopefully I can show you one day. On the big screen.
You definitely need to throw up a video of the wrong-footed hypnotizer. I think that would break. Well, it would break Steve, and then it would break the internet.
Look at us just making that like the norm. That's what it's called now. This is great. Get this man into NFL training camp right now. Get this man into NFL training camp.
This is what we're saying. This is what we got to achieve.
This is what we're trying to do here on the PFF NFL podcast. Get Tig.
There you go.
Into NFL training camp, Mr. Leader.
How easy have you found it doing both kicking and punting? Because that it's always, we had this discussion on last week's show that like how different are those skills to the point where a genuine professional specialist in the NFL can't be cross-trained to be functional at both, right? Like kicking and punting. Like you have come from a completely different background in rugby, but have been capable enough to be able to pick up both pretty quickly.
I was always surprised, but when I got out, like working with other high-level guys, the guys in the league or guys on the edge of the league, that how early people specialize into one. Because, yeah, I was just kind of going out to practice and kicking balls. I was able to hit spirals and stuff. And then some of the feedback was, well, you know, one or the other, kind of pick one or the other, which I listened to, but I still wasn't overly comfortable with, because, you know, I'd see guys punting and thinking, I'm doing that, like, you know, just messing in the warm up kind of stuff. So I was a bit surprised by how the expectation just to do one and one only. I appreciate in the NFL, obviously it's an extremely elite level, but I would think that guys, I'd be an advocate. Like I wouldn't like to, if I had to drop one for the other, of course you'd listen, but I think it's, you can do both. From my experience at least, I think you can definitely do both. And like the good thing was for me, from a punting perspective, in our third game, our punter got injured in the warm up. So our coach just kind of said, "Hey, they call me Tiger. Just it's easier than Tig and the pronunciation." So I rolled with that. Plus, I have like tiger colored boots or cleats. But yeah, the coach just goes, "Hey, Tiger, can you punt?" And obviously, I just nodded my head and said, "Yeah, sure. Like, give it a go, give it a crack." And they have very specific mechanics. I think that's required. But as long for me, I was slightly unorthodox, but like I loved it. One thing I loved about punting over kicking was I'm my own holder. So it relies from a punting, a field goal kicking perspective. You know, if your hold's not good, it is difficult to get the job done in that 1.2, 1.3 time frame. Whereas punting, you know, it's obviously we have to snap, but I enjoyed the aspect of, you know, it's yeah, I, you know, if things don't go well, it's most definitely on me. I enjoyed that side of it. And then alongside just trying to use the different styles of kicks and fool the returner. But I think it's transfer. I think guys can, my experience, but keep in mind I'm limited, so I don't want to be offending any vets here or like, who's this Irish fella like telling us all we can do both. But from what I've seen, yeah, I would definitely want to continue in that vein.
I think the tricky part though, and I mentioned this on our last show, is there's 32 jobs in the world for punting. There's 32 kicking jobs in the world. And you have to be one of the top 32, so to speak, and preferably a top 15 or 16, right? You want to be in the, when you're evaluating for your team, I'd rather have one of the better punters. I'd rather have one of the better kickers if you can even evaluate that. So I think that's the tricky part, right? Being a good kicker is being almost perfect in the NFL. Being a good punter, you know, the difference between good and below average is 7, 8, 10 yards of field position, right? So it is significant. And I think that's part, probably the tricky part, is there's, you know, there's not a backup punter. There's 32 jobs and that's it. You know, so you do have to be really good at both.
I like the idea though of, you know, punter goes down the warm-ups, you turn to the rugby playing kicker.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, can you punt? To which the answer is, well, certainly better than anybody else here.
Yeah. Like your wide receiver is not going to be punting like I can.
I can definitely kick it further than the offensive lineman over there. Put it that way.
Like Wes Welker's not coming in punting or kicking extra points anymore.
How important is, or does rugby, does the kicking experience from rugby help with the speed that you have to get everything done by, right? Because that's one of the big things in punting, is like the just the execution time, right? Ball comes back, hits your hands, you've got, you know, a very small period of time in which you have to get it rid, otherwise the thing's getting blocked.
Yeah, so that was, so the punting, that was a really exciting piece of the puzzle actually, because I hadn't done specific punt training because I was focusing on kicking. So when I was punting, you know, when the coach says, can you punt? And in the warm up, I was taking punts and I was taking like one step, two step, three step kick. And then the coach just goes, well, you got a two step because you got to be quick here. To which in my head was like, wow, okay, the little bit of training I've done is three steps. Okay, I got to change everything now in the next 20 minutes. and I went to my punter who was hurt. He was like, hey man, just like, don't worry about it. Do what you do, do your three steps. And like, you, the guys cover you, you should be all right. And then I was kind of like, okay. And then when the first ball came to me, I don't know if I blacked out or what happened, but I just went right foot, left foot, kick. And went inside the 20. And I remember like walking over to the sideline and my punter, who was like great dude, was absolutely buzzing for me. He was just like, bro, you did it. You did it. You did two steps. And I was like, did I? What, like, what exactly happened there? So that was like, it, just kind of like learning on the job and just letting like your body just take over. But from playing rugby, one of the biggest strengths I think I have now is my get-offs. I got some 1.07 get-offs. My average is probably like 1.5. So my hands are very quick, hand to foot, which I'm hoping is, you know, when coaches look at that, okay, this guy's raw, but like I was moving quick from a two-step point of view from a punting. And then from a field goal point of view, in rugby, you know, we set it up on a tee, you have 90 seconds, you go back, you take your breaths, you do your thing, you know, you take your time. So that didn't translate to football really in terms of, from the timing point of view. It was one thing kicking out in San Diego in shorts and a t-shirt and kicking off sticks, which is what I did, you know, most, it was all my training, to all of a sudden having some pads on, some big 6'6" fella trying to jump at you, and then guys rushing around the edge and having 1.2, 1.3 to get the job done. That was a different kettle of fish, but I really enjoyable, and you know, it heightens the senses, because if you're, you know, if you're off by a fraction of a second, you're in trouble. So that was probably the biggest learning curve to kicking field goals, is just how rapid you got to be. Once you give that head nod, you're rolling.
As a former rugby player, now what can you add to the kickoff coverage team? Are you just gonna not what a normal kicker is? You know, they give like a little, you know.
Well, first you need to find out what kind of out half was he, right? Was he a, you know, Ronan O'Gara absorbed the contact kind of 10, or was he a guy that would actually go out there and hit somebody?
He was you a 10? What position do you play?
Yeah, 10, fly half.
That's what I was going to say, actually. Yeah. I knew he was a 10.
For the sake of this podcast, I was like the Johnny Wilkinson standpoint, which is try and light guys up.
There you go.
Say that.
Okay, so now that's another selling point, right? I mean, if you're kicking off, we have 11 legitimate tacklers.
We're gonna have some Pat McAfee style hits going.
Yeah.
On.
Okay. So that's another good selling point.
Yeah.
Fill your lane and light somebody up.
I will say it was the first or second game when I kicked off and the returner was making some yards upfield, and in the corner of my eye there was a guy, like, not the ball carrier, but you know, one of his blockers, like, is who it was, and he was. Like, I remember like 15 yards away, he was like approaching me and I could see him on my periphery. And then all of a sudden he was 10 yards away. And then I remember thinking like, what the hell is this? Like, this fella's coming from me. And then it dawned on me, it was like, oh, in football, they can block. So I'm a target right now, and just trying to like react late, because I've never experienced, you know, ball being 15 yards that way with a dude in front V-lining for me. So that was a quick learning experience, just trying to like, ride that contact and stay alive to try and make a tackle. Thankfully the dude ran out of bounds, but yeah, I definitely was wouldn't say shaking in my boots, but that was like a quick like wake-up call, like, oh, I'm a legit target here at any time.
I learned that mid-play. That's great.
How different have you found doing all this with pads on for the first time?
Not as different as I would have thought. I think I noticed the helmet even more so. Yeah. Than the pads, because I was told find the smallest, skinniest pads you can find and chuck those on your shoulders, you know, because you don't need to. So thankfully I found the smallest, skinniest pads I could, but the helmet was more so, I think something to get aware of on the bars.
Yeah.
That was a bit different. Oh, that was very different. So that was different. But then also my first emotion, I guess, or feeling when I put everything on was like, wow, like this is invincible. You feel invincible when you have all that stuff on. I could see why guys light each other up. That was like the first thing that came to mind.
That's great.
Yeah, you get dissuaded from that feeling though pretty quickly when a 300-pound offensive lineman meets you for the first time. Suddenly realize that actually the pads don't necessarily protect you from everything.
Yeah. If I can avoid that for a while, I will. Yeah, gladly stay out of the way of the big boys.
The one thing I wanted to ask you to wrap this up is, I've been thinking about this for a while, but what aspects of rugby do you think could be brought into football to sort of add an extra element to offense? Because of the way rugby works and the idea of, essentially endless laterals, right? That's rugby. And suddenly you add the idea that the element that you just talked about, that you can block, right? You can set up rugby moves with the addition of being able to actually block people that would ordinarily be part of the defensive line. Like, do you think there's elements of rugby play, open play, that could be brought into football that the league just isn't paying attention to right now, just isn't aware of?
Yeah, so you kind of mentioned it there, but I was quite surprised. So in training, I'd catch with the quarterbacks. At practice, I'd catch with the quarterbacks, and then I would just zip it back, rugby style. And the guys were like, "Wow, like that? How'd you do that? That thing's moving like the underhand lateral." But I was surprised by when guys are throwing laterals. It's relatively like loopy. The ball's it's not like a firm zip pass, and they kind of use this overhand target. Mm-hmm. So I was just I was surprised, and I guess curious as to why maybe there isn't a little bit more, especially for the guys in offense behind the line, when they are like, from a lateral perspective, why they aren't more aware of how to absolutely throw those bullets versus that kind of loopy ball in the air, giving the defense time to react. So that's one thing that I think there's definitely value, because now I'm learning about football. Margins of a second make the biggest difference. And if you can throw like a 7 to 12 yard bullet underhand versus that kind of more ball in the air for a second and a half. So that's one area I think could definitely be value. And the quarterbacks and stuff were asking me like, how'd you do that? And so just so they could try, because I guess they hadn't really seen it been done, at least at that speed. So that's one area I think there's definitely some value to be added from the rugby passing, at least.
Yeah, I mean, Arizona ran a play last year where I think it was by accident, but they almost sort of designed an overlap by running this kind of shallow crossing pattern that on the far side had like a fake bubble screen. And once the fake bubble screen guy was done with his fake, he ended up essentially in a perfect trail
right behind
position.
The drag.
Yeah, for the lateral. But there was no lateral on the play, right? It wasn't built into it, but they'd managed to sort of design this play where they'd taken away a defender from that side. They were now an extra man if they had been able to use the extra man. But the only way of doing that would be somebody completely ad-libbing a lateral or building in a rugby pass off the back end of it.
New England used to have plays where they would set it up so they were getting either a pass to the running back or to the shallow, and the other guy was right there to maybe block for him.
Yeah.
But it'd be the same idea, right? Like the hook and ladder.
Right.
Like just more – the hook and ladder is usually a quick hitch. Somebody loops behind them, and it's – yeah, you kind of catch it, But it's just more creative ways of setting up the hook and ladder would be interesting, I think.
All right. That'll do it.
Thanks, Tiger.
Absolutely. So,
cheers,
listen,
fellas.
If you're an agent, if you are an NFL team, if you are making personnel decisions anywhere in football – go look this guy up. Go to Twitter, tag leader, TADHGLEADER, at tag leader on Twitter. That's where you'll find all the stuff. That's where you'll be able to get in contact with him. Let's get this guy on an NFL roster.
I think
this is a cool story.
Yeah. We got a month. We'll get you into training camp. If not this year, definitely next year though, right? Start building up the brand.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And the good thing is, it's been unreal. It's been funny to see the support from back in Ireland. Like there's no one really doing this. So it feels like half the country got behind me, which I guess Ireland's pretty small.
It's like you.
It's not the biggest amount of people. Yeah. But hopefully it's been cool to see all the support from Ireland and now getting more kind of recognition here in the States. So I appreciate you lads giving me a chance to chat, and hopefully the right people are listening.
Absolutely. I need you to make it just so I can keep talking about rugby on this podcast.
I need to get a baseball. Can we get Mike Trout on here or something? He's a great football player.
I'll leave that to you.
Okay. Yeah. I'll figure that out. Thanks, Tiger. That was awesome. Really appreciate it.
Cheers, man. Thank you.
So there you go. It's Tiger. Mm. You should have just told me his name was Tiger.
Well, yeah, that would have got you pretty close. You got way closer when you actually tried to do it than when you were talking before the show.
Yeah.
Like, you had some bizarre.
Well, I know that ADH, it was going to be some like different vowel sound, and the whole thing was going to be, is it ADH?
No.
AH, whatever it is. Did you delete it?
Yeah.
Whatever it was. I knew that the letters there were not going to look, you know.
TADHG is the spelling.
So those middle letters that you just listed there.
Were like talking about O sounds.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what the A sound was.
And there wasn't the G anywhere near the thing you were talking about before.
Yeah, but why would you pronounce a G? You guys just pick and choose whatever letters you want to pronounce. So that's what I did. But I almost got there. Almost. For Tiger. Yeah, yeah. And go check him out. And go check out @PFF_Sam. Go make your donation to see Sam look like minor league Steve.
He sent me he DM'd the Twitter video of the wrong-footed hypnotizer.
Already, huh?
It's pretty impressive. It's pretty cool.
All right, cool.
We also, by the way, we need to give this guy a shout out. Somebody was trying to mail us coffee but tea bags. You know, we had that rant a while ago about why isn't coffee just selling tea bags the way tea.
Yeah, and a lot of people came back and said that's just not how it's not how it works.
Yeah, but why? That's the question I posed to you, Steve. Why? Anyway, some guy was trying to send them to me. His name, he signs off with Russ, but he's the guy from Russia.
It's short for Russia.
Was it Ishevsk? Was that the place? But so when you get the email from him, right? Oh, it's Ruslan. You get the email from him, it's all in Cyrillic. So it's like gibberish to me, but it's fun getting an email in Cyrillic. You expect the IRS to be, or like, no, what's the INS, which...
watching it.
Yeah, yeah. Like some feds should be breaking down my email and you know, checking for collusion or whatever.
Oh, good news, by the way.
Anyway, the upshot of that was they couldn't mail the coffee bags to us. So he sent us an Amazon link instead.
So we'll get the coffee tea bag. So yeah, if you want to send us some swag for the table, whatever it is, unsolicited. We're not soliciting.
You just solicited. Do we need to like give an address? How do the 2-for-1 people do this? I haven't listened to their.
That's a good question. I thought I turned this volume off.
How do they beg for crap?
You can ask us for our address at NFLpodcast@pff.com.
There you go. Singular podcast.
If you have something good to send. We'll send back the email, the address here at the PFF studio.
Are you saying they have to like tell you what it is before you're prepared to give it out?
I mean, I'll accept surprise. These surprises were great.
Tell me what your present is, and then I'll tell you whether or not it's worth me sending you the address of the building.
I'm just glad. I mean, you get a lot
pretty
of
pretty sure you can also find the address like on the website, right?
It's probably somewhere. Up there. And go apply for some jobs at PFF.com.
It's got to be in that footer somewhere on the basis that footer is like a mile and a half large. Like somewhere in there has got to be the building address, right?
I would think so. So anyway, appreciate everybody. Appreciate all the listeners. And we'll be back here on Monday with more
Monday
NFL action. Thanks, guys. See you Monday.